From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 10 years ago with the release of a book called When Religion Becomes Evil, Five Warning Signs. Dr. Charles Kimball wrote the book to make the case that there are ways we can discern when religion or when religious people are heading into potentially violent territory. Kimball has been clear throughout his career in distinguishing some important points. The first is that in just about any religion, the vast majority of the adherents are peaceful. They behave just as anyone else. They raise families, go to work, struggle with bills. Kimball has also said that it doesn't take much for the fringes of organized religion to become violent. After all, a small number of people can create havoc on a global scale. And Dr. Kimball is in Rochester today, a guest of the Hickey Center at Nazareth College. The center focuses on interfaith studies and dialogue, and they're in the midst of a three-day conference focusing on a range of issues. Tonight, Dr. Kimball will offer a presentation titled When Religion Becomes Lethal, The Explosive Mix of Politics and Religion. But first, he's the director of, well, chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of five books, including When Religion Becomes Evil. Dr. Charles Kimball, welcome to Connections. Thanks for being here. Thank you very much, Evan.
Nice to be here.
And Dr. Muhammad Shafiq is with us as well, the executive director of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue. And Dr. Shafiq, always nice to have you back here.
Thank you very much.
You're in the midst of this conference, Dr. Shafiq, and you have a lot of different themes here. Give us sort of the overarching goal of this particular 3 days.
So we have 52 presentations, and the scholars come from, mostly the scholars are from U.S., but there are some from Canada, some coming even from Filipino, Indonesia. So we have a good mix of scholars. And all the papers which are there is talking about how religion responds to violence. So there is three, you can say it's quite a bit of panels which you can see how it is happening throughout the day. So we have, last night we had a keynote speaking about issues of terrorism and how terrorism has come into being. And we have a luncheon speaker, then Dr. Charles Kimball will be speaking tonight, and then also tomorrow up to 2 o'clock. So it's a variety of panels, variety of discussions, variety of papers which are presented there.
From best I can tell, looking at Dr. Kimball's career, your work goes back looking for peaceful solutions, looking for interfaith dialogue many decades, certainly before 9/11. But 9/11 kind of catalyzed this interest in some of your work. And so you've appeared in a number of different media publications and shows talking about the intersection of religion and violence. So before we get to politics, let's start with what you wrote in that book 10 years ago and why you wanted to present to the public this notion that there are some warning signs that we may be heading into violence.
Right. My academic background is in the comparative study of religion. I have my doctorate in history of religions, world religions from Harvard. And particularly following 9/11, when the world attention was so focused on these dramatic events, 19 people hijacking the 4 planes and literally changing the world, one could argue, I was particularly interested, and I've been looking at this over time, to say, okay, if we take a step back and look across the different religious traditions and through the centuries, can we see patterns that will help us identify how people go off the rails, how people who claim to be and seek to be peaceful, loving adherents of the different religious traditions end up doing horrific things. And so that's where I developed the kind of paradigm of these five warning signs saying, and this is not unique to any religious tradition. I have examples from all the major religions to illustrate this is more of a human phenomenon and I think a misuse of at least what the vast majority of people in each of these traditions have affirmed historically over time. And so part of the challenge, as we saw with 9/11, is, as you noted in the opening, we now know that it doesn't take many people to wreak havoc on a global scale. And so even though there are 1.6, 1.7 billion Muslims, 19 people, and maybe a couple hundred people behind them who knew about this plot on 9/11, could wreak havoc. I mean, that doesn't even measure on the scale among Muslims, but it certainly is dangerous and real. So how do we see not only what might be coming at us, but what we ourselves might be capable of justifying, because Christians and Jews and Hindus, Buddhists and others, but particularly I focus a lot on Christianity and Islam. I think these as the two largest religions have the most in their history I would say, to be ashamed of in terms of what's been done in the name of their religion.
And I want to ask you a little bit about a question that some listeners might think, well, that's unfair, but I think it's fair. I think it's fair to ask if your estimation is, and you can tell me if this is a relevant question or not, were the 9/11 hijackers religious? And I ask because I've heard you say in previous presentations that, you know, we don't know exactly what was in the minds and hearts of the 19 hijackers on 9/11, but you have pointed out that Muhammad Atta and others left notes indicating right. that they did think they were taking action in service to God and that they would soon be in paradise.
Right.
Do you think that they were religious people?
At least some of them. I think that the materials that was left behind by Muhammad Atta would certainly indicate that he saw this, he expected this would be rewarded, and saw this not as a defensive act. We've been attacked and we're fighting back. And that's part of the Al-Qaeda manifesto. I mean, this is the kind of thing bin Laden used to talk about a lot as well. We don't know if some of the people who were hijackers knew what the actual plan was, that they were going to fly the planes into buildings. Obviously, a handful of them had to because they took control and,
sure.
you know, flew the planes. But some of the others may not have even been clued in as to what the outcome was going to be. They're just things we don't really know or understand. But clearly, some of them, at least, were motivated by a sense that this was their religious duty or they were doing something that God would reward them for this.
The reason I ask, and I think it is relevant, is because as you discuss, I think somehow, Dr. Kimball, you have this way of cutting through what can be such a tense subject, which is when people ask, well, this person committed an act of terrorism. Well, that's not the real representation of that religion. That this religion is peaceful. Christianity is peaceful. No one should bomb an abortion clinic. Islam is peaceful. No one should fly a plane into a building. It gets to be very hot. And so I think when you distill it in a way that says, look, the vast majority of adherents to religion are just like anybody else. But when you've got any fringes at all, it doesn't take much of a fringe to be very, very dangerous
right.
in a world context. But the reason I think it matters is, you know, there are going to be some who look at religion and say, well, anytime you have religion at all, there is an element that will corrupt it or view it in the most extreme or literal terms. And you may never create a world free of a dangerous fringe, even if that fringe is sincere, even if that fringe thinks religiously, not just politically, not just sort of sadistically, but actually sincerely religiously.
Oh, no, I don't think there's any doubt that, at least in the case of Muhammad Atta that we know more about, that he was sincere. I mean, you don't fly an airplane into a building on a lark. You have to be convinced you're doing something, you're giving up your life. Sincerity isn't the question. You can be sincerely wrong and misguided. I don't think you'll ever totally eliminate. We're not going to, you know, I don't think we're going to see heaven here on earth because we're dealing with human beings. And that's part of the dynamic. One of the things that just sparked in my mind as you were talking, there's a tendency, I think, in all of us, a tendency of in all people who are active and practicing as religious adherents of one sort or another, to think of their own religious tradition in terms of its ideal and everybody else in terms of the flawed lived reality that they see. And so Christians talk about, well, Jesus taught a gospel of love. Period. But we know that there are things that Christians have done, the KKK or Westboro Baptist Church or Crusades or Inquisitions and so forth. We know that, but we put it in a context. I speak here as a Christian myself. But Islam claims to be a religion of peace, but look what they're doing. And so there's that tendency to look in those terms. As I like to point out to people, as a rabbi, very good friend who's since passed away, once pointed out to me, he said, you know, 2,000 years of Christian love is almost more than we Jews can bear. Yes, Christians, Jesus taught a gospel of love, but if you look at the history of anti-Semitism, it's a very, very ugly history that doesn't seem to have anything to do with loving your neighbor as yourself and treating other people as you want to be treated. And so there is that disconnect, and I think we have to be honest and look at the fact that human beings are flawed and find ways to justify behavior that seems to be contradictory to what they say is at the heart of their religion.
I want to ask if you want to add that, Dr. Shafiq?
Yeah, I was just thinking the papers which are so far presented, you can see that there are, you know, in all faiths, you can see some quotes which could be causing those issues that, you know, how some people can misuse those and how they can create hatefulness and animosity. So the papers are bringing those quotes, how they are misinterpreted by some elements. And also, you know, there is a brainwashing when you get into that circle of people who had some motives behind it and how they brainwash young people who can think that they are the only people who are on the right and the rest are all wrong.
Yeah, we're going to get into where sort of political manipulation comes into play here. And in a moment, I do want to just briefly talk about the warning signs of where Dr. Kimball has identified where a person who is religious may become violent. Before I do, though, let me let our listeners know. We'll take your phone calls and emails throughout the hour if you like. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. You have said, Dr. Kimball, that people who are really well-intentioned, who want to not broad-brush a religion, can kind of fall into a trap where they are very sincere, but they end up almost accidentally justifying violence or destructive behavior that happens in the name of religion by either refusing to sort of grapple with the sincerity of someone like Muhammad Atta or by missing warning signs. Can we talk a little bit about that? Do well-intended people sometimes muddy the dialogue on this?
Sure. One of the things we have to constantly bear in mind is that, to build on what Dr. Shafiq was just saying, the sacred text, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, or other sacred text, these are not systematic theologies. It's not all clearly laid out, and here's how all the pieces fit. This is why you have ongoing work of theologians and interpreters to try and make coherent sense of things that were not written as systematic theologies. And so interpretation is always part of the process. Last count, there were over 20,000 different recognized Christian denominations in the world. Well, that alone tells you that people who seek to be followers of Jesus are not all agreed on what exactly that means or how to interpret the authoritative text and so forth. So we're always in a process of interpretation and making sense. And part of what makes things challenging and difficult is that most of us tend to read our sacred texts selectively. We zero in on certain things that build on our own theological understanding or things that make sense to us and tend to skip over the things that don't make so much sense or we find some way to understand or justify or whatever. And this is part of what he was referring to in some of the papers. There are passages, or many passages in the Quran, for example, that talk very positively about Jews and Christians and the people of the book. There's a passage that even promises they too will have their reward. Paradise is promised for those who follow the light of those traditions. But you also have a few other verses that can be interpreted if you take them in isolation, and which is what the violent extremists tend to do, as fighting back or the sword verses, you know, go out and kill those who are infidels or misrepresent God, etc. So this is it depends on how you approach the interpretive process. And if you look at any, that's really what I was doing in the book, was saying we can see horrible things being done in the name of religion across the board. So what are the kinds of things that make that more possible? Are there patterns? And that's what I've tried to identify, some of the patterns that facilitate that.
It would be its own hour just to talk about the five warning signs. So let me just sum up from the short list. We'll talk a little bit about that, then we'll take some phone calls. And we'll get into in our second half hour what they're going to hear at the conference from Dr. Kimball tonight. But as I read it, the five warning signs of when religion could be moving in a violent direction with an individual is the following. Number one, whenever a religion emphasizes that it holds the absolute truth, the one path to God, or the only correct way of reading a sacred text to the exclusion of the truth claims of all other religions and cultures, that religion could be becoming evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number two, blind obedience to religious leaders. Number three, apocalyptic belief that the end time will occur through a particular religion. Number four, the use of malevolent ends to achieve religious goals, such as the Crusades. And number five, the declaration of holy war.
Right.
So those are the warning signs.
Right.
And do we need to do a better job as a society of seeing those warning signs among us as they're happening?
Sure, I think so. And I think the point is, it's not, we focus on what's dramatic and sensational, the things that get the headlines, but a lot of these things are present in local churches or in local communities in one way or another. Too much authority invested in too few people We see charismatic leaders emerge, Jim Jones or Asahara Shoko, the Buddhist guy who convinced people to release sarin gas in the Tokyo subway system. You can go down the list, David Koresh in Waco, Texas, and so forth. So we see that kind of example. Let me come back to the first one and tell you a sort of, informative little anecdote. When the book first came out, in the first couple of years, I did over 40 hours of radio interviews, among TV interviews and other things too. And when people would want to talk about the five warning signs, the typical thing that would happen would be I would talk first about absolute truth claims. And we would almost never get to the other four. And when the phone lines opened up, the first four or five people to call in would be proving my point about absolute truth claims because they were the ones who actually knew what the absolute truth was. The thing to remember is we're all human beings. To quote the Apostle Paul out of my tradition, we see through a glass darkly, not yet face to face. None of us have all the answers. None of us have everything locked down tight. None of us see the world exactly as God sees the world and the universe. And so whatever kind of truth claims we're affirming, and I'm not saying it's all relative, I think those are very important, but we have to always have a measure of humility and a recognition that there's more to learn. If you think of it in a Christian context, if there was nothing else to learn, why would you go to Sunday school? Why would you have a Bible study? Why would you listen to a sermon? Presumably because there's new insight, new way of understanding. But at a practical level, we find all kinds of people, particularly people who have radio and TV ministries, I find, who seem to think that they have all the answers. And many people like to gravitate towards somebody who tells them, here's the answer. I'll make it easy for you. Here it is. That's a dangerous sign.
Humility. More humility is what the world needs.
Exactly.
In this and all contexts.
At least a measure of humility,
I think,
to be sure.
That's powerful stuff. Let me get David in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, David.
Very interesting. The last statement you made really spoke to me. I'm interested in the intermingling between religion and what is a political motivation, power, and how it's used by almost all sides, whether it's the situation in Ireland before, the situation where why terrorism in this country is using Christ as a base, or whether it's, the situation on both sides in Israel today. You know, is it politics, is it religion, and which defines the difference between the two? Thank you. I'll leave it at
David, thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this begins to move into some of what I'll talk about this evening in another book that I wrote on religion, the volatile mix of religion and politics in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They're always connected. In one way or another, because you're dealing with human beings, and if human beings are themselves religious, they're bringing some of that into the political sphere. What David is referring more to is the political motivations of people who are actually claiming, sometimes sincerely, sometimes more cynically, using religion for political purposes. We've seen plenty of that. I'll give a very visible example with Saddam Hussein. This guy was a secular thug of the First Order, and yet, after the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, suddenly he got religion. He had Allahu Akbar sewn onto the Iraqi flag. Iraq was a secular government. He began to talk about liberating Palestine, and that resonated with people across the region. I mean, it was all cynically done in order to gain support when he was getting beat up pretty bad for the invasion of Kuwait. And you could see right through it. People, we see this in different parts of the world, but of course in the United States, no political leader would ever use religion for political purposes. That only happens elsewhere in the world.
Is that right?
Yeah, right. I think you got the point of my cynical comment there.
Sure.
It happens all the time, and we see it, just turn on the TV any given day and you'll see a version of that in any country.
I keep coming back, just as David the caller did, to your point on humility and that first warning sign, when the absolute truth is promised to the exclusion of all other considerations, you find danger there. And that lack of humility can extend to religion in the political realm.
Right.
Either when it's sincerely held religious fervor and therefore a desire to govern on that basis, or a manipulative way to say, I have the answers, only I have the answers, follow me. I find that a very powerful and dangerous combination.
Yeah, and I would even soften it a little bit to say that even if you're convinced that you have locked on to something that is just absolutely true, mm-hmm. In my mind, that's still okay at a certain level. It doesn't measure much humility or take seriously your own humanity. But if you hold something to be so absolutely true, that in and of itself isn't the problem. The problem is when you begin to punish or persecute others who don't share that same view. If you want to go sit on a mountain somewhere and contemplate the absolute truth that you've discovered, go right ahead. But where we see the danger sign come in is when people begin to abuse that and persecute people who don't interpret the text the same way, who don't share their political vision or their religious vision. And that's where it translates very quickly into... So when you see people who are attacking and harming other people in the name of religion, that's when the warning signs should be flying all over the place.
My guest is Dr. Charles Kimball, an author and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's written 5 books, a couple more on the way, and he is someone who's been talking for years about the intersection of religion and violence, not saying that religion is the cause of violence necessarily. In fact, his point that we need to really be embracing of our humility and reaching across our differences and trying to pull together and understand when violence is possible and what are the signs and the warning signs that it might be possible in certain contexts. So he's in Rochester as a guest of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue, and he's presenting tonight on the subject of When Religion Becomes Lethal, the Explosive Mix of Politics and Religion. Dr. Muhammad Shafiq is here, Executive Director of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue. It's 844-295-TALK if you want to join the program as we talk religion and violence and politics, religion and politics, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Don writes to the program and says, does your guest think, did the warning signs generalize to any non-religious ideologies, communism, nationalism, anarchism, etc.?
I think possibly so, yeah. I think in many ways, various isms can function like religions in a broad way. And so I think some of the
blind obedience to leaders.
Right, right. And absolute truth claims. The end justifies the means and so forth. Yeah.
The ends justify the means are something that you talked about, 5 years ago now when the Tsarnaev brothers were, and the Boston Marathon bombing.
Right.
Exactly the kind of claims that they were making. Well, we believe in X and therefore the ends justify these violent means, right?
Right, right. And in the case of what we quickly label terrorism, we have to always sort of bear in mind that terrorism is a weapon of the weak. It's a way for people who don't have a Sixth Fleet or military power to fight back in their minds against forces that are oppressing them, whether they're right or wrong. That's their perception. And so how do you hit the Achilles heel of that power that is oppressing you? Can't go toe-to-toe militarily. And so when you do a terrorist act of some sort, blow up a marketplace or whatever, you're basically seeking to get attention to your cause. And the cause is the end. You know, we want people to understand this is what's happening to us. And so I'm sacrificing something here to call attention to that. There is a logic to it. And in a sad kind of way, terrorism in that sense works because the media always gravitates towards what is violent and explosive. If it bleeds, it leads. And so small numbers of people can get a lot of attention to their cause if they're willing to chop off someone's head or do something horrific that the media will cover.
Dr. Shafiq, do you agree with Dr. Kimball? And again, I'm paraphrasing, but I think Dr. Kimball's point when I raised the question on whether will there always be fringes on major religions, fringes on just about any religion that could be violent, will we always have to sort of, is that the trade-off? And I think Dr. Kimball is saying human beings are human beings right. For a reason. We probably always will have that in some form. The goal, of course, is to try to mitigate and lessen that as much as we can. Is that part of the trade-off with major religion, Dr. Shafiq? Will we always have violence in the name of it?
I think such elements exist almost all over the religions, all over the faiths. But when they become evil, when they become violent, I think social justice could be counted. Even in countries which, as far as my study is concerned, even there is a dictatorship, but if social justice to some extent is there, really just those elements, it's hard for them to become violent. It's a justification. There is a dictatorship, which human rights doesn't exist much, but and then the social rights are, social justice is violated. Then these elements gets a chance to come and become more evil and take terroristic activities. That's one way. Then a second thing which I see among religious elements when they become sort of violent is sometimes the state also sponsors such people for to prolong their existence, to prolong, in other words, rulers to prolong their rule, they incite such people to take to go to the streets and to say that there is no other way but, in other words, to keep stability, I have to stay in power. So these two elements are there. Whenever in such countries there is a political stability, social justice are there, you may see that such elements who have belief, extreme belief, may not be able to become, you know, they don't have a chance to get into terroristic activities.
And I would just add to that, I think it's under the umbrella perhaps of social justice that he's talking about. Often economic exploitation is a huge factor too, the being disenfranchised, small numbers of people controlling most of the wealth, others feeling like they're cut out of the picture, they're not given anything. And that leads to, you know, even more unrest in the sense of injustice that they're fighting back against.
So, for example, ISIS, if we take that, so there was a political, I mean, there is still political vacuum if you look, if you see that. So there is a chaos you can see in the whole region. And also, you know, how unemployment is there. So social justice is lacking there along with political vacuum. And that's why they become a force. How to fill up the gap. So that's what, you know, they believe in that way, that that's the only way to frighten people, to take law and order into their hands and come into power.
Societies with more equity have less violence. Okay. Let me grab a phone call from Nancy in Irondequoit, who wants to talk about the notion of truth. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi. I do want to talk about the fact of truth, that people think they have the absolute truth. I happen to be a Unitarian Universalist, and one of the tenets in our so-called faith is that, quote, we believe in truth known and to be known, unquote. And I think if everyone had that sense of humility of not knowing everything and knowing their own truth, I think maybe that would solve some of the problems. So I would just like to recommend that people consider that truth known and to be known.
I think that's a wonderful way to phrase it. I like that very much. Here's an exercise for listeners. If you're active in a congregation, ask your minister, ask your priest sometime if he or she goes back and reads their own sermons from 10 or 15 years ago. And if they do, you know, what's that like? And I tell you from my own experience and others I've talked to, sometimes it's pretty painful to go back. Occasionally, there have been a time or two when I've gone back and read a sermon that I gave 15 years ago and found something stunningly brilliant. And I was just amazed that I had that thought and, you know, how insightful it was. And then it hits me, if it was so insightful, how had I completely forgotten it in the last 15 years? So we're all human beings, and we should be able to change our mind. We should learn and unlearn things as we go. How many of you would be interested in hearing a sermon from somebody who hadn't had a new thought in 10 years? None of us. So all of that speaks to the need to not just learn, unlearn, but also things that we can learn in the future, as Nancy so nicely put it.
Nancy, I want to give you an example of my personal life. I was born in a remote village, and my mom had never gone out of the village. So when I grew, went to the college, she one day went with me to the city where I was studying. And I was, you know, meeting with people, talking in a different language. And my mom says, Sunny, are you possessed by some demons? Because you are speaking in different language. But once she stayed in that, in other words, getting out of the village, stayed in the town or city for a while with me, she realized Oh, yes, there are more people in the world who speak different languages, who are different than what we are in our village. I think many of these people who define truth in that way as absolute, that they have not been exposed to others, other cultures, other faiths, other way of living.
I think that's well said. Let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. I've got more of your phone calls to work through. I want to ask our guest, Dr. Kimball, generally speaking, what he's going to focus on this evening with his comments regarding the intersection of religion and politics and how you see perhaps nefarious or troubling intersections there. So let's do that. Let's get that break. We'll come back. We'll grab some of your phone calls, and we'll come back and talk more of what Dr. Kimball is bringing to the Hickey Center at Nazareth College tonight, right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what would a post-Roe v. Wade America look like? Recently on this program, we had a conversation with the panel self-described as pro-life, looking forward to a post-Roe United States. Today, it's a conversation with panelists who self-describe as pro-choice. They're not looking forward to it, but they're going to talk about the practical realities for New Yorkers, Americans, women. We'll talk post-Roe America next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Let's grab a couple of phone calls. Gloria in Canandaigua has been waiting. Go ahead, Gloria.
Yes. Hi. Hang on just a second. Let me put this on. There, that's better. My husband and I recently saw a seven-part series called The Keepers. I think it was on Netflix. And I'm wondering, you know, what that was about was a priest who was a pedophile and in a high school. And it was pretty horrendous. I'm wondering if you deal with big mental health issues like that, pedophilia, and how that influences in that series, the church totally defended this pedophile priest. And I don't want to ruin that for anybody, but anyway, I'm wondering if you deal with mental health issues like that.
I don't specifically deal with mental health issues as such. Let me say something about this horrific problem of the pedophile priests or people who have exploited children. In the chapter in When Religion Becomes Evil, the chapter on the means and ends, I use this example. I studied over 100 cases of priests who had been, many of them convicted, but had been accused of this behavior. And the pattern that emerged, I mean, there were all kinds of circumstances. Sometimes the priest would be moved to a different parish as though somehow it would make it go away. Sometimes families were paid off, you know, for their silence and so forth. But the common theme that ran through it all among many of the bishops who oversaw these cases was that they were concerned that one bad apple would spoil the whole barrel. We can't let the church and all the good things that we're doing be undermined by this, so we want to make this go away. In other words, the end was protecting the sanctity and distinctive contributions of the church, and so the means was justified with that goal in mind. The problem was, of course, that, you know, as this came out, they did more to undermine and destroy the confidence in the church. But that was a classic example of means and ends, where they knew it was bad, but the goal was to protect the integrity of the church. And any time you raise something up as a goal and make it a kind of sacrosanct reality, you run the risk of finding ways to justify all kinds of things in order to get to that worthy goal.
Let me get Keith next on the phone. Keith is in Pittsford. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting discussion. But I want to ask your guest, the author, why do we actually need somebody to preach to us? Why do we need somebody to tell us what's morally correct? I mean, I'm not a churchgoer. I don't go. I have no desire to go to any organized religion, even though I was at one time. And I consider myself a very moral person. I mean, the worst thing I do is swear, but I just don't see you need a leader, or you need a preacher or a rabbi or a priest.
Okay, so I guess what I'm getting from you is, why do you need a religious leader to offer a moral sort of structure? Okay.
You're right. I mean, why go to a building to have a preacher preach to you, but he's going to preach to you what he wants to preach to you, whether it's right or wrong.
But that's true of all things, Keith. I mean, if you went to atheist congregation, if you went to conversations about Harry Potter fans, they're going to talk about Harry. There's, of course, that they're going to talk. I don't really understand that.
Well, wait a minute. I don't think Harry Potter sit around and talk morals.
Okay.
I mean, okay. Essentially, our religions do is try to, you know, teach you what's moral. And I'm using air quotes.
Well, let me just interject here and say I certainly would argue very strongly with you that one doesn't have to be a practitioner of a religion to be a moral and ethical person.
I
agree with that. I think that's religion serves a lot of different purposes, and that's a function. But there are all kinds of other things. I worked for a decade or almost a decade directing the Middle East office of the National Council of Churches. And one of the things that we did was coordinate mission and service ministries, particularly in war zones. And so part of what the churches did was when we had a war, we could combine our resources. People want to do something to help refugees, to help people who need medical care, temporary housing, whatever it might be. Well, one church can't do that, but collectively we could do a whole lot of things together to help people in need. And you see this when there are earthquakes, when there are natural disasters of different sorts, how people come together and try to do something to help people in other places. There are all kinds of things that congregations do, not only Christian, but Muslims and others. So I would say I would want to broaden pretty dramatically what the churches and religious institutions do. Only one part of it, I think, is the preaching and the sort of moral guidance. And I think, to me, the ones that are best is when you have a leader who is in the struggle along with you and providing guidance or insight, and even admitting, I've changed my mind about something. I've learned something new this week that I hadn't thought about before, whatever. But I don't think that's necessary for someone to be a moral and ethical person.
Okay. Dr. Shafiq, you want to add to that?
Yeah. I think, Keith, it's a human phenomenon. You know, as humans, we have a lot of issues in our life. And we look for people, whether religious or non-religious, to give us some guidance. So mostly in that sense, you can see why people go to places of religion also, where they can get some advice, where they can cool down. And mostly that's what the places of religions are about. And and to overcome some of the issues which they are having in life. So it's a natural phenomena, whether people are religious or not religious, they look for guidance one way or another way to have some moral lessons in their life.
Let me just quickly add, too, I think this it's a broader point. Both Dr. Shafiq and I are professors of religious studies. And so we don't preach to our students. We try to teach. We try to help them learn how to think, how to ask questions. And we always have students or people who want to say, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And part of the goal is to say, well, you're the person who lives in your skin. The important for you to think for yourself. I want to help you formulate questions, challenge presuppositions, not do the thinking for you. And so in that sense, a good religious leader, I think, isn't so much dictating as encouraging people and helping give them the tools as a teacher would. To think for themselves and realize that people of goodwill will often come to very different conclusions as they wrestle with whatever issues they're wrestling with.
We're talking to Dr. Charles Kimball, who is in Rochester as a guest of the Hickey Center for Interfaith Studies and Dialogue as part of a 3-day conference that they have with several dozen scholars. And Dr. Kimball is an author and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma, among many other things, in a long background that I could spend a long time reading from. But I'll tell you, he's written 5 books, including When Religion Becomes Evil, 5 Warning Signs. And tonight he will be offering a presentation titled When Religion Becomes Lethal, The Explosive Mix of Politics and Religion. What do you want those who listen to you tonight to take from that presentation?
I would say a couple of things. One, what I'm doing, what I've tried to do over a period of years and put together in this book, is taking a step back and saying, okay, we have people, particularly in the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic traditions, who are making all kinds of claims about what is the proper relationship between religion and the state. What is an Islamic state, or what is a Christian nation, or how should Israel be structured as a Jewish state, and so forth. So I'm taking a step back and saying, okay, well, what are the actual sources? Where is the source of authority for making these claims? Well, what does the Bible say? What does the Quran say? What are the Hadith materials, the practice of the Prophet? And how has that actually played out then historically? And at the risk of giving away too much, I'll say there are a couple of things that are the takeaways. One, religion and politics are certainly always connected in some way. How exactly you do that, none of these traditions actually provide a template for how to do it. Despite what people are claiming, there is no clear template for what an Islamic state should look like or what a Christian nation should be. And historically, we find they're all over the map with all kinds of experiments that are always connected to times, to places, to circumstances, and that's the way it actually has to work out. It has to be relevant. Israel, for example, the model one could find would be a monarchy with King Saul, David, and Solomon. That's kind of the high water mark under David and Solomon. But when Israel came back together in the 20th century, nobody was clamoring for a monarchy. They developed a new political structure that was relevant to the 20th century, that drew upon the best of the traditions as they saw them politically, and formulated what they call a Jewish state in Israel, but it has nothing to do with the biblical model. If you look at Islamic states, and I won't go into details that I'll talk about some more tonight, you've had a couple of experiments and a number of people claiming that they know what an Islamic state should be. Pakistan was created to be an Islamic state. It's been a mess for three quarters of a century. I don't know anybody who would line up to take classes from the Pakistanis on how to organize an Islamic state. Iran is another case in point, a very different kind of approach and model that's been put forward in the Islamic Republic of Iran that drew heavily on Western European parliamentary democracies and threw in the Ayatollah and so forth. So there's all kinds of experiments going on and people advocating for things, but these are interpretations. There is no definitive way to define an Islamic state or a Christian nation.
Hmm. You want to add to that, Dr. Shafiq?
You know, recently there was election in Pakistan, and you can see that how the religious elements, all of them, who took part in the election, lost the election. So almost more than two-thirds majority are who are elected there are, you can say, they are secular elements and how they view politics and religion. So it's amazing phenomena, which is in the third world country, especially those who consider themselves religious, people are looking who can deliver social justice to them. That is the main issue. It's not the religion. It's not the secular element. It is the social justice. So I think so far, those religious elements who have been in the politics, they have failed to deliver social justice. And that's why I think in the recent election, they are hoping that the secular elements may be able to deliver social justice. And that's what people need.
And I think there's a real desire across the world for forms of participatory government where people actually have a voice and some say, not being under a dictator or an authoritarian figure. We've seen a lot of pushback against that. But the way forward isn't exactly clear, and part of what complicates the picture enormously is that in some settings you have violent extremists who claim it's my way or the highway and I'll kill you if you disagree with me. Well, that does tend to shut down discourse when you have one element that isn't interested in talking but simply pushing their view. So it's a very messy situation, but one that we have to always be aware. We have to be looking at contextual situations. You can't speak about Pakistan as though that's Morocco or Syria as though that's the Sudan. You have a lot of dynamics, and these are different places with different histories, different contexts, different tribal groups, etc. And one of the dangers that we see is that many in the West, especially many of our political leaders and religious leaders, tend to think of Islam in monolithic terms. And by definition, they're then going to be saying things that simply aren't true or don't apply.
Let me read an email from a listener named Amanda who says, Evan, thank you for such thoughtful guests this hour. I'm wondering about religion and politics. My concern is that violence might have a broader definition than what you've been talking about this hour. I'm worried about our current vice president, who might one day be our president, and the violence that might happen to, for example, gay families, gay marriages split apart. Is religious justification coming for more upheaval? And is that a form of violence if we see it? That's from Amanda.
I would agree with Amanda. I think the And part of what I'm really trying to get at in the When the Religion Becomes Evil book is that while we focus attention on dramatic things like bombings or war, there are all kinds of ways that people do violence to one another through words, through actions. And so we have, it's a call not only to see what's out there that might come at us, but what we ourselves are capable of justifying in terms of the mistreatment of other people in large and small ways. So I think the kind of warning that she is raising here is very well-founded.
Okay, let me get to another phone call. Joyce in Penfield. Go ahead, Joyce.
Thanks very much, Evan, Dr. Shafiq, and for this program. Actually, what I was going to say, I think, may duplicate what Amanda already was raising, and partly it's whether it's not necessarily a small group of extremists that put us at risk, but an environment that gets influenced by leaders, and that environment encourages domination, violence, lack of respect. You know, and in our present political, in our present climate, the number of political leaders, primary leaders in our government, do believe in Christian superiority, even believing this country is supposed to be a white Christian nation, which sounds like a harsh statement to make, but I think that the research will show us that, and even in an apocalyptic future. So combined with policies designed to increase economic disparity between the very rich and others, you know, do we have a recipe for something pretty important? And what are we going to do to turn that around? Hmm.
Joyce, thank you. Dr. Kimball?
Yeah, I, again, I would very much concur with that. I worked for a couple of years with an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. It's a very old pacifist Christian organization formed around the time of World War I. And when I was interviewing for the position, of course, they wanted to know, well, are you a pacifist? And my response was, I aspire to be. because none of us, I think, can say in all honesty that a word here, an attitude there, some kind of even nonchalant behavior can be hurtful to other people, can be violent in some way or another, that nonviolence is something we should aspire to, but recognize it's not just hitting somebody or an act of war. And so to be attuned to that and to constantly go back to one of the basics that we find in all the world's religions, that the golden rule, you know, would treat other people the way you'd like to be treated, continues to be a very nice measure for, you know, how to behave.
I want to thank Betsy in Brighton for calling. Don't have time to take the call on air, but she did have a response for Keith's question. She says she goes to church not just for teaching, but to have a sense of community. Certainly, Betsy. And I take that point. It's a valuable point. There's so many wonderful things that can come from that sense of community. So thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Keith, and everyone who called in. And we're down to our last couple of minutes. So I will ask Dr. Kimball, in all of your years working on the subjects of religion and violence, on the subjects of the intersection of politics and religion and how that interplay with violence and structures can sort of be exploited. Are you an optimist? Are we moving in a direction that makes you feel more or less comfortable for future generations?
I think we're in a very, very difficult moment, not just in this country, but in the world. And I think the next 15 or 20 years are going to be pretty rough no matter what happens. If the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were solved tomorrow, that wouldn't fix Syria and all kinds of other regional problems, for example. So I think we're in for a rough period ahead. I remain fundamentally optimistic because in my experience, I've spent a lot of time in the political realm here and also throughout the Middle East on 35 to 40 occasions over the years. At a very deep level, I find a commonness among human beings who want a better future for their children and their grandchildren. And people, even most people who feel very wronged and aggrieved, are willing to give up a lot for something better and more hopeful for their children and grandchildren. And that gives me hope that we'll continuing to sort of wrestle with and look for ways forward. But I don't think there's a magic wand or a quick fix. And in fact, I would say anybody who stands up and say, I've got the answer, everything's going to be fine, or as our president has said, I alone can fix it, I say run the other way, because nobody has a simplistic answer to solve the complex problems and the grievances and frustrations that are very real for people throughout the world.
Dr. Shafiq, 30 seconds. I suspect you are an optimist.
You know, a little bit worried about the world situation, especially what is happening in the West and what is happening in our country. It makes me that what will happen in the future, because I had great hopes that this will be West and our country would be a model for the rest of the world, how diversity is appreciated, how diversity and inclusion could be a model for the world. And I'm really worried about that, that things are getting not in the right direction.
Well, I know that your work to bring together different voices, different religious leadership and scholars continues, Dr. Shafiq, and this three-day conference is just another example. And you ought to really just follow along if you can with what the Hickey Center is doing. We always appreciate the conversations you bring here, Dr. Shafiq, and thank you for taking the time to be here. And Dr. Kimball, we hope that you have a nice day in Rochester, and we really appreciate your expertise and your insight this hour. Thanks, Evan.
It's been very nice to be with you.
Dr. Charles Kimball is an author and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Among his many books, When Religion Becomes Evil, 5 Warning Signs. We appreciate his time this hour. Short break, more connections coming up.